Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 28, Episode 11. Coming up on the show, we've got the novels of the Astro authors, Spontaneous Post-Traumatic Growth Syndrome, and the naughty sprite that trashes your ride. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Well, we don't necessarily know that it trashes this particular author's ride, but it plays a very important role in proving its point to him. Let's just say that. Because on this episode, we're going to go into some wild stories of premonitions. And, you know, I'm always kind of skeptical with premonitions because I find plenty of people have dreams and, you know, weird feelings and vibrations. And they go, oh, I think something somewhere at some point might happen. And it's like, okay. Like, that's all very well and good to, you know, make a very kind of ambiguous claim, but I really like focusing on the stories that have some verification. And this is what the book by Herbert Greenhouse focuses on. It's premonitions, a leap into the future.
Yeah, so highlights that kind of stuff. You've been going into the 33-cent paperbacks from the 1960s.
I love these books.
This order came in. He spent like $600. He opens this huge box and all this ancient dust just goes... And there's all these old little, you know, there's little paperbacks from the 1960s, 70s that are like $4 at the airport. He's going hundreds of them.
They are the books that hold some of the best paranormal information. I was like a kid in a candy store.
Here. How you go through them. Some of them are so corny.
Like, oh, yeah, some of them.
The ghost, the biggest spooky haunted house of the 1980s.
Well, we've got Halloween coming up, I did have to set the scene with ghosts, so we will be going to that as well. But what have you got coming up in this episode?
It's pretty fluffy stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, we just did that. Those two big shows that were very hardcore. We had to go to some chaff.
I was looking at a 2021 book from Steve Taylor, and Taylor, he writes your kind of predictable self-help stuff in the style of Eckhart Tolle and his colleagues. In 2017, just to give you a sense of what he's about, he wrote a book called The Leap, The Psychology of Spiritual Awakening. Mm. And then in 2014, The Calm Center, Reflections and Meditations for Spiritual Awakening. And then back in 2012, there was Back to Sanity, Healing the Madness of Our Minds.
Okay, so it sounds like he's got kind of a theme going there.
You get the idea. He's like a... Guru-esque. Psychology, spirituality, self-help guy.
Mm-hmm.
And this new one's really interesting. It's about people he calls shifters. And he goes into something he's termed transformation through turmoil, or TTT for short. And essentially he interviews these people who go through tremendous suffering that seems to trigger not a gradual change, but just this 180 degree flip in their entire being. He's got all these examples of people that just change instantaneously.
You mean as in walk-in style?
Like, for example, an alcoholic who just, or a heroin addict who just wakes up one day and is no longer addicted to heroin.
Can that happen?
I don't think so, but he's got all these cases of people that just, and then they just completely change and then they're never tempted again. They never relapse. Something happens. And he seems to think, and I think I agree with him to a certain degree, it's a breakdown of the ego, this deconstruction of attachments and the ego of the individual. And then it's like a new person comes forth. And in the cases I'm going to mention in the Plus extension, it really is like a new person is driving the body. But there's some cases where I think I'll let you listen along and you let me know what you think. But to me, some of them feel like perhaps the daemon's taken over, or even it's a case of a walk-in where an entirely different personality is now driving the body.
Yes,
because some of these reversals are so strange. Like there's one where this woman's she's an alcoholic. She's been an alcoholic for 20 years. And all of a sudden, her hand won't let her drink. It's like her.
Like she's paralyzed. She can't send the message to her body.
She goes up to drink, and something else controls her arm and puts the drink down. And this happens time and time again, until it's like there's an external force physically stopping her from drinking.
Interesting. That sounds like it's actually going to dovetail quite nicely with what I'm going to be describing. Because as much as these stories are about premonitions, it's more so about. It's like there is some type of force, some type of intelligence, which is maintaining the fabric of reality. And in doing so, human beings and our experiences play a very, you know, integral part to what occurs and what takes place. So people have these premonitions. And I've spoken about these sorts of premonitions before where people have experiences. They are mostly dreams. I mean, some people can have spontaneous visions that erupt. You know, there's crazy stories out there of people that will be, you know, like what would that series of movies where, you know, death keeps on chasing people down.
Final Destination.
Yeah, that kind of stuff where people will be driving along and then all of a sudden they'll have this vision of a truck crashing before them. And so they'll be so disturbed by it because it's not like just a typical kind of daydream. It's an actual vision when they feel it. They pull off to the side of the road. They wait, you know, 10, 20 minutes. And by the time they get back on the road, then all of a sudden they see this truck on the side of the road that would have slammed into them, you know.
And so, then when they get home, a piano falls on their head and they die.
You're not too far from the point, right? Because for some people, in some reported cases where they have premonitions, they do everything they can to avoid that specific circumstance of the premonition, and they do die sometimes in, I dare I say it, quite hilarious circumstances, right, such as having a piano fall on them or something like that, you know? So it's a really good example of that. Even if you know what's going to happen, you can't do anything about it. And it's like, well, why? Why is it that certain people will have a premonition, but then it will cause the actual effect to take place? And we're going to go into that a little bit later on in the show. It's called Your Appointment with Samsara. And this is, you know, it's an old legend that came up in a fictional book. But as is pointed out by Herbert Greenhouse, this is quite fitting for a large number of stories of premonitions that have led to death that have been researched by him and other authors as well. And the reason why I really enjoyed this book is because it is really kind of a precursor to things like the Premonitions Bureau. And we covered that book back in episode 2409. I'll link to it in the show notes so you can go back and listen to it if you like. It details, you know, the life of J.C. Barker, the man who was instrumental in bringing about the Premonitions Bureau. And the Premonitions Bureau is a fascinating concept, and I can see why, you know, Barker worked so hard to try and bring this about. But he ended up succumbing to his own psychic catastrophe, which kind of fits in with what Greenhouse was describing. But Greenhouse wrote this book back in the early 1970s.
What was the Premonitions Bureau again?
Let me refresh your mind a little bit about it. So the Premonitions Bureau came about because there was the Aberfan disaster in Wales.
That's right.
And if you recall, what occurred there was that it was a large, massive coal that was being held back on a mountain.
It swamped the town.
There was a huge amount of rain that had happened and it gave way, and it did. It swamped the town, but not only did it swamp the town, it specifically swamped this school. It killed, I think, 100 and something children. You know, it was an absolutely horrible disaster. Almost 200 people died in total. But what started coming out of it is that there were people coming forward saying that they had had premonitions of the disaster occurring, and it was happening all around the world.
And they found sketches of kids drawing.
That was the other
thing. Disaster before they died.
There were parents that were coming forward saying, you know, and showing drawings that the children had done. And there was like a kid who had drawn a picture of like a little man who had been surrounded by huge amounts of what appeared to be black dirt. You know, and these visions were happening beforehand. And there was this little girl that the day before the disaster went to her mother and said, "Oh, I'm not afraid of dying. It's going to be dark, but I'm not scared of it." You know, all these weird premonitions that took place that were only, you know, in a way validated after the event took place. Well, J.C. Barker thought, this is such a terrible disaster, obviously. Maybe there's something we can do about this. We can get, you know, a premonitions bureau together. And what that would be a central reporting complex where people could phone up, people could send in their submissions. There was a pro forma that he had established, so you fill out all your details and it would be sent through and reviewed by a group that was at the premonitions bureau. There was one established in London. There was another one that was in New York. And if enough people wrote in with these experiences, perhaps they might be able to do something. Perhaps they may be able to prevent a terrible disaster taking place. And he actually got a group of people together, J.C. Barker, and he teamed up with a reporter from the local newspaper, and they were going to go on a television show back in the 1960s. And some of the people that were, you know, reporting their experiences and premonitions, particularly of this, you know, Aberfan disaster, they were sitting in the back of this green room. And when they were in the green room, the host of the television show just kind of just ducked his head in the green room to have a look. And immediately he's like, "I'm not having these people on my show." And look, this is the 1960s, so it was far more conservative than it is today. And it's not to say, it's pointed out here in an article that was published by Sam Knight. Look, these people weren't, obviously off the limits of being completely weird, but they were odd. And as a result of that, it kind of was like, well, you know, these people are nuts. But they'd had genuine premonitions because they were able to be validated. So the idea came about is that, well, if we can get enough of these and we can prove these events, we might be able to stop a terrible disaster. And if we stop even one, that's all that's going to matter. And apparently in 1967, they actually got one. They found that there was going to be a terrible plane crash that was going to happen. They didn't prevent the plane crash from happening, but in a more scientific way, they were able to prove before the event took place that there was enough information that had come through to show that these premonitions were real. People were genuinely having these, you know, these visions and these premonitions. They weren't just crackpots that were, you know, calling up the local newspaper. So more of this is actually detailed in that episode. So go and check out that episode. But for this, you know, one thing I want to point out is that there was the story of Kathleen Middleton. And Kathleen Middleton was quite fascinating. That she was one of these people that was able to pick up on these incredible premonitions. And she seemed to be, I don't know, essentially destined to have these abilities, because when she was a child, she'd been in the kitchen, and when she was in the kitchen, a fried egg flew up into the ceiling, like something that's kind of
that's
got a poltergeist. Well, it is, right? It's kind of weird. So she, her mother takes her to a seer or to a psychic, and the psychic is like, yeah, your daughter is special. Yeah. She's going to have all these experiences. And she did. She had a life of premonitions. And before she had, you know, premonitions, she would have headaches. Like she would have a band that would tighten around her head. This is reported by multitudes of people that would have these similar sorts of experiences where it would be not just simply a vision. They would smell something. They would have a physical response to an event that was going to take place. So obviously this would be, you know, of great benefit to governments. And with Greenhouse, he basically highlights the Titanic, and he points out very early on in the book that there were many, many people that seemingly subconsciously suddenly cancelled their trip on the ship. And it's quite odd. Like, why would they do that? And many people were later questioned as to why they cancelled their trip. And the response was, I don't know. I just got a bad feeling. Or no one got a specific, a lot of people did get specific visions. They saw the ship sinking. People saw wild and crazy things. But for a lot of people, it was just, oh, well, I got a weird feeling about it. And Greenhouse goes on to say, well, it's a possibility that there are enough people that have this ability that they could equal or rival the number of people that are left-handed. It might be just some type of trait that human beings have. And if we could hone this, and this is what J.C. Barker was highlighting, we could stop a disaster like this happening in the future. And all we'd have to do in the case of the Titanic, let's say if the Premonitions Bureau existed back then, enough people wrote in, they would be able to say to the government, you need to hold off on the ship and delay it for even 24 hours.
You could almost get all these people together and they could use their abilities to predict crimes. And then you could go and arrest the perpetrators before they've done the crime.
But that's brilliant. The thing, right? So there is this idea that of a pre-crime and that kind of stuff. And this is where it does become dangerous. And, you know, another thing was pointed out by other people that were involved in doing research or, you know, presenting, you know, their experiences to the Premonitions Bureau is that some of them started having this weird effect where they would have a premonition and then the disaster wouldn't occur. And it was like, because then they would intervene, right? So the vision started disappearing for some people. And it was almost like if you had a premonition of the of a disaster taking place, but then you intervened and then the disaster never took place, then the premonition would never happen. Because so it's got this weird kind of
destiny.
Paradox to it.
You're messing with destiny.
It really is destiny. And ultimately, you know, J.C. Barker, he was told by Kathleen that she was extremely worried about him. She said, oh, I've got this horrible feeling that you're going to die while you're young. And that's he was right, like, yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, come on. And around the time, and I picked up a copy of his book, he ended up right as the Aberfan disaster happened. Because he was a psychologist or a psychiatrist, he was writing a book describing his patients' experiences, because very early on in his career, he was focusing on ORCID patients. And what ORCID patients are people that have extremely rare psychiatric conditions. You know, one of them that he was particularly fascinated by is Munchausen by proxy, which is where people injure usually their children, but other members of their family deliberately make them sick so that they can get attention. But he started to notice that there was kind of this weird paranormal aspect that was happening. He was finding that there was like a psychic ability amongst people. So things like premonitions were coming up. So part of his research was looking into this. And of course, Aberfan happened around the same time. So again, this destiny plays a role. It was like he was kind of set up on this path to go and follow this stuff and do this kind of research. And the book at the time when this disaster happened that he was working on was Scared to Death, and it was focusing on cases of people that would have a premonition, and that premonition would be of their death, and it would then lead to their death, which is something that back in the 1970s, Goodhouse in this book, Premonitions, focused on. This is the Samsara, you know, appointment. So before we go into that, though, let's just take a look at a couple of cases that kind of set the scene for, you know, what's going on here. And he starts talking about later in the book, but I think it's better to mention it at the start. He talks about Jules Verne. And of course, Jules Verne, you know, the famed writer, he's, you know, seemingly wrote a number of books that were, obviously they were science fiction, but they were very advanced for their
visionary.
Time. They were visionary, absolutely. There was something about them where this guy had an uncanny knowing of the future. And I was like, well, kind of where's Greenhouse heading with this? But it all becomes clear in a moment. And he points out, you know, there's the book Round the Moon. Round the Moon was written almost 100 years, or in fact, you know, 100 years exactly before the Apollo missions. And Round the Moon describes the Columbiad. And the Columbiad is this spaceship that was heading towards the moon. It was traveling towards the moon at 7 miles per second. So it was going to take slightly over 4 days to get there. He starts pointing out, this is Greenhouse, the similarities between Jules Verne's book, Round the Moon and the Vessel and all the details, and that of the Apollo missions that happened 100 years later. So he points out that the Apollo 11 command module was called Columbia. It too took just over 4 days to reach the moon. So it's like, there's no way. I mean, Jules Verne possibly could have spoken to people to be able to calculate this, but it's unlikely that he would have known the exact timing that it would have taken to get to the moon. There were things that apparently was about the rockets, the way that the rockets were designed to jolt it out of the Earth's orbit and to get it into the moon. This was similar between the Apollo rockets and the Columbiads. Apparently with the computer comparison, so Jules Verne describes the computation of the flight trajectory and other flight information. This was calculated in his book at Cambridge Observatory in England. Well, it just so happens that the Apollo trajectory and flight computing and other such information was calculated at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Laboratory, which is in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hmm, interesting.
So just little things, right?
It's a little bit like Philip K. Dick, where people said he actually had visions of other dimensions and other worlds and other futures, and then he wrote about it in the guise of science fiction, but he was really having these visions.
Yes.
Maybe it was the same with Jules Verne. He was having visions of the future, prophetic visions, and he just wrote it down as science fiction.
Exactly. And this is where Greenhouse is saying, you know, it's like so many people have these experiences, you know, and most of us just kind of take it for granted. And he does point out, if you look at some older cultures, for example, or some, you know, less well-developed cultures as well, or less modern cultures, you know, and we were only just talking about this on the last episode with Lyle Watson and his experience, you know, landing on this, you know, unusual little island somewhere to the west of Bali and finding this tribe of people that readily believe in telepathy, you know, almost teleportation, a porting of objects, you know.
Pulling out their eyeball to win a battle of wizards.
That kind of stuff as well. Yes, psychic battles, all those sorts of things. Go back and listen to that episode as well. This kind of idea. So it's like, it's only in modern times where we've kind of gone down this path of, well, it's not possible. Like, that doesn't happen. Oh, well, you know, no, it's just, when it's really, there's a whole heap of evidence to suggest that even in the West, this stuff has been happening for a long time. And in the past, it had been used to our advantage. But today, and when I say today, the 1970s, but even more so today, it's being dismissed, it's being ignored. And unfortunately for our friend Barker, Barker ultimately, in this strange irony, if you recall, he seemingly succumbed to his own illness, metaphysical illness, because he had one, or in fact, he had two of the people working with the Premonitions Bureau tell him that there was going to be something terribly wrong happen to him and he was going to die. And he didn't believe it. He's like, oh, I didn't believe. But because two had said it, and they also confirmed other details in his life, they kind of had premonitions of other events in his life, it set up this scene for what he referred to as voodoo death. And this is the idea. It's like in Australia, you know, with the Aboriginal Australians talking about the pointing of the bone, where, you know, people will be told that they've had the bone pointed at them and they'll just simply lay down and die. And from a medical perspective, the idea is that, well, this is like an adrenal stress. This is a kind of an overload of the adrenal glands and an increase in blood pressure. And it all happens as a result of a nocebo effect. And, you know, the book points out that we know quite well about what happens with the nocebo effect, where people are on certain medications or they might be on a placebo, they think it's the real medication, and it causes negative effects. There was one great example that was highlighted by Greenhouse where there was a guy who was involved in an antidepressant trial, and he didn't know what he was on, but he truly believed that he was on the actual antidepressants, right?
Yeah.
And he started to get better. He was like, it was obviously working, and he was reporting that it was getting better. And then he kind of got a hint that maybe, like, no one said anything, but he got this hint that he actually wasn't on the actual drug. So he started to become depressed again. And he became so severely depressed, right, that something again flipped. And he's like, oh, I must be on them. And see how he kind of went on this roller coaster. He took a massive overdose of what he believed to be the real drug. And it seems like he was, because his blood pressure went through the roof. He suffered extreme adrenal stress. He had all of these physical symptoms, which were consistent with someone taking a drug overdose, of having like a serotonin syndrome overdose episode.
But he was on the placebo.
He was on the placebo. And you know what happened? He was lying in this hospital bed. He was plugged into all these machines. He was at death's door. He was almost dead. And one of the assistants that was on this program had come over and pulled out the records. They unblinded the study and were like, you're not on the drugs. And immediately, within moments, the machine, everything stabilized, yeah, pulled the tube out.
Good day, everyone. He just walks out of the hospital.
That was sugar then. Oh, okay. Does anyone have some coffee? And off he went. So that's a really good example, though, of just how potentially suggestible people can be. And that's what the focus of Barker's work really was. As much as he tried to get the Premonitions Bureau off, you know, off the ground, he never did, because he actually did die. He died when he was like 42 years old of a brain hemorrhage. Now,
what do you do though when two psychics who you've been working with say, oh, there's grave danger, you're going to die? What do you do?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you change?
Well, and this is the wild thing.
Okay.
So they described that he was going to suffocate. You know, one of them, I think it was Kathleen, described that he was going to suffocate, and he ended up dying of a brain hemorrhage. But I was reading today that even though he had a brain hemorrhage, he had a brain hemorrhage in the area of the brain which would influence breathing. Or the, you know, the I guess the regulation of breathing. So he experienced a suffocating effect. Now, Kathleen also described the moment that he died that she was suddenly overcome with physical sensations of being unable to breathe. So it was like, and this is something that Greenhouse also goes into, this weird connection between, and the emotional connection between people that have premonitions and have telepathy and these sorts of things. And, you know, it was noted at the very end of the book, and I'm kind of doing this book about face, because most of his arguments are kind of that set up the scene are actually at the back of the book and not at the start. But he points out, this is something that Carlos Osis, you know, the great researcher, noticed, is that when it comes to telepathy, there seems to be some type of proximity that's connected to it. So if you're in close proximity to a certain person, it seems like you're more likely to have a premonition about something that's going to happen in their life.
Do you mean
actual
distance, physical distance?
Actual physical distance, right? Other researchers have highlighted this as well, except where the difference comes in is when you have an emotional connection. So with the emotional connections, it's like mothers and their children, or fathers and their children, or people with their siblings. It seems like those sorts of premonitions and connections can span, you know, distance and time quite easily. And there's a number of cases that were looked into by a German researcher. But before I get into those, let me mention some of the proximity ones, for example. So there's two proximity cases that are highlighted by Greenhouse. The first one relates to an Australian woman who, it must have been in kind of the mid-1950s, maybe a little bit earlier, but she had a governess, you know, essentially a nanny that was looking after her children. On this particular day, she'd been very stressed, and a whole heap of things had been happening in her life. So she just, and it seems like that emotion again might play a role, but she decides to go for a walk, and she says to the governess, oh, look, can you please look after the children? And the governess then says, oh, yep, that's not a problem at all. I can do that for you. So she goes for this walk. Now, she goes off and has this walk, and she walks this vast distance. And as she walks the vast distance, she sees this smoke coming up. Like, there's this smoke, this spiral of smoke kind of coming up in the distance. And it's kind of from her direction, because she must have been heading back towards her home. I think she got the impression that it might have been connected to her home. And immediately, when you're reading a book about premonitions and it's referencing, you know, what the governess is doing with the children, you think, oh my God, you know, is something happened to the kids? Is she getting a premonition, or is there a fire at the house? Is she rushing back? No, the story's not about that at all. She sees this smoke, And she walks up kind of over this hill and she reaches a fire break. Now, as she reaches this fire break, she walks through it and it's like she walks through, I don't know, some type of barrier, some type of etheric field. I don't know what you describe, but she's suddenly overwhelmed with this panic, like this horrible panic, this fear, the feelings of adrenaline is just surging all through her body. She starts running. She's like, she's like, doesn't know how to get, she's panicked. She doesn't know. It's like she can't escape the situation. So kind of disoriented, she runs. And as she runs over to this spot in the distance and she stops on the spot and everything kind of calms down for a second. It's like there's this sudden calming and it's like an abrupt stop. It's this abrupt stop where the feeling's gone. She's like, oh, she's in a void. It's like, well, what the hell just happened? And then it hits her. Well, she now starts to have this surge of emotion, which is even worse than what she experienced before with the panic. It's a trauma. It's some of the most physically horrible feeling you could ever possibly imagine. Multiply it by 10. It's just overwhelmingly terrible. So she thinks it's the kids. She just starts running home. Yeah. She just bolts home. She bolts home and she gets inside. And the governess is like, oh, the children have been playing and they're all fine. She's like, what the hell was that? Well, and she feels fine again. The smoke's gone though. She never saw where the smoke came from. She has no idea what has taken place. And it's really difficult. And I could understand like going through something like that, obviously, because there's nothing, right? You start to think, am I going crazy? You know, and especially if you've never had a panic attack or any type of, you know, even though you've had stress, what the hell just happened? Like there must be a problem. 2 or 3 days later.
A piano plane. Drops on her head. Dead.
A DC-3 plane comes smashing down at where she'd been walking. It smashes through the fire break, as in it skims and smashes through the fire break and then crashes and bursts into flames on the very spot where she had been, right? So it's like when she got to that fire break, she picked up on the emotion of the pilots panicking as they were trying to control the aircraft. She then gets to this spot to sit down. When she sits down on this spot, she finds out that there was 2 pilots. They both died. The first pilot died instantaneously. That's the void that she felt. The second pilot was living for a while. He suffered extreme physical and emotional trauma as he lay trapped in the aircraft as he died.
Why would she pick up on that? Was she just... She was close to the location.
She was close to the location. This
but
is
surely
the
there was other people there as well.
Well, I suppose so. But this, well, no, she would have, because this is out, I think it was in Mount Macedon or something like that.
Oh,
it's like
okay.
an isolated right. bushland kind of location. So, but it was about the proximity, physical proximity.
Not proximity in time, though.
No, not proximity in time and no emotional connection whatsoever to this location. And yet she picked up, but she couldn't do anything about it.
But again, this is the idea that future events that are traumatic ripple back through time.
Exactly. And if there had been a premonitions bureau, if she had, you know, and it doesn't say this, but I actually think this is more about what this is. It's like if there was less of a taboo and less, I mean, there's nothing wrong, obviously, with healthy skepticism. And that's why I pointed out, you know, with a lot of these cases, there's a lot of nutters out there that will just make outrageous claims. I mean, have you seen, you know, cryptocurrency on Twitter? I mean, there's a lot of lunatics out there that'll just make the most wild, outlandish claims that just nothing ever happens. And it's exactly the same with this sort of stuff, but with enough reports and the removal of that stigma to a degree, you might be able to get some type of understanding of a disaster that's going to take place. You know, a really great example was the crash of that DC-10 where that guy, I can't remember if it was in Chicago, outside of Chicago, but he kept on having dream night after night after night of this massive jetliner that's going to crash, and he couldn't do anything about it because even though the dream was visceral, he couldn't get the tail number. He couldn't work out what airline it was. He just couldn't. And he even ended up calling the FAA. And the FAA pulled him in afterwards and wanted to know if he was involved in the crash because he knew so many details but didn't know exact details.
You know why he couldn't get the exact details?
Why is that?
Because the DC-10 was meant to crash.
And that's what it is. Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like there's this fabric that's being maintained where things are supposed to happen the way that they're supposed to happen. But going back to these stories of proximity and emotion, so that one, that particular case is definitely a proximity case. And she didn't see anything. She saw the smoke, right? But she didn't see a plane. She didn't get anything else. So this was not only a proximity case, it was very much a feelings case. And you can't base anything on these feelings. I mean, yeah, I mean, you had a panic attack in the woods. What are you going to do? How are you going to report that? There was another case, though, that was a little bit more visual, where a woman was holidaying in Ireland and she had left her hotel and had gone for a walk and she'd found this beautiful location And when she'd walked across, you know, up this kind of hill and it came out to the seaside, and she was sitting on the seaside when all of a sudden, like, she's up at a high cliff, she's overwhelmed with this horrible feeling of despair and sadness and hopelessness. And she's like, what the hell is this? And as she's feeling this, this smoke, this black smoke bubbles up from the surface of the water. It actually comes up in like a cloud and then kind of hugs the side of the cliff, moves up the cliff, goes over the side and kind of disappears behind her, right? And she's like, she spins around to watch where this cloud had gone. The cloud congeals into this young man. It actually turns into a young man. The young man just goes running past her and jumps off the cliff. And as soon as it jumps off the cliff, the feeling dissipates and it's gone. Now, she's thinking that, you know, even though she doesn't appear to be psychically inclined by any means, she's like, I'm in Ireland. It's a very old location. I've just seen a ghost. It's just a ghost. She then is in her hotel.
Suicidal ghost.
Well, it is a suicidal ghost. And I'm thinking, and that's what I was thinking as well. I'm thinking, well, maybe this poor woman witnessed a suicide that had taken place. And maybe this ghost just keeps on repeating the incident over and over and over. It was a precognition. Because she picks up the newspaper a few days later, the local newspaper, and finds that a young man fitting the description of what she had seen had jumped off the day before the newspaper was published, but a couple of days after her experience. So in that particular location, in that very location. So she had a precognition experience of the suicide of this guy, but only because she had no emotional connection to him.
I wonder if these people have other experiences like this, or is it just a one-off, just a strange one-off because of the location?
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, because throughout this book, when it's highlighting many of the characters, you know, that have come up through history, you know, you mentioned there Philip K. Dick, but what I'm going to be talking about, some of the authors, you know, Jules Verne, some people had implied that Jules Verne was quite psychic, that he had had, you know, certain visions that were unrelated to his books. He just had other experiences. Another person who's had similar experiences is Morgan Robertson. Now, Morgan Robertson, you may recall, he's the author of the novella The Wreck of the Titan, also known as Futility. And the reason why that book stands out is because it was published 14 years before the sinking of the Titanic. But much like Jules Verne in Around the Moon, Futility had these just uncanny similarities to the sinking of the Titanic. Like, it was the Titan in his book. It sank in a very similar location to where the Titanic sank. At the time when The Wreck of the Titan or Futility was published, there were no ships that were of that magnitude, that size. I mean, the Titanic and the Britannic and the Olympic, they were gigantic ships for the time.
I can't believe you're talking about Futility. This is the Roswell of precognition cases.
Oh, it is, right? Of course it is. Yeah, no, of course it is. But I mean, I find it outstandingly fascinating. But there's more to it, right? And you're right, it is a very, very well-known story. But the reason why I mention it is because Morgan Robertson is actually a very intriguing man. Morgan Robertson had a lifetime of psychic encounters, a huge lifetime.
This is the author.
This is the author. He had a huge lifetime of psychic encounters starting from when he was a very young child. Now, as soon as I read that, I start going, hang on a second. This guy published a book which is uncannily like the sinking of the Titanic, an event that took place 14 years later. Did he actually write it, or did he just do a retelling of what he saw? And Greenhouse claims that's exactly what happened to this guy.
Yeah, makes sense. It's like with Jules Verne and Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
They're writing down their eyewitness reports.
It becomes even more wild than you can possibly imagine, Ben, because this is where you have another entity that comes in. There's an arrival of some type of entity. And he referred to this entity as his astral assistant, his astral author. And so I don't know where Greenhouse got this information, and there's no way to validate it because I don't know. This is published 50 years ago. You know, Greenhouse is probably long gone. He claims that Robertson would have this event where he would go and sit at his typewriter and he wouldn't be able to do anything. He couldn't write himself. He would sit for hours on end to get himself into a blank-minded state. Where he would enter into a trance.
So he's just doing automatic writing.
No. Contained within his typewriter.
What?
Was the entity that would come out. The entity would somehow be contained within the typewriter. It would come out and take him to locations to see things.
Hang on a second. So you said he's psychic as well, though. So he's had all these childhood experiences, but that has nothing to do with this scenario.
No.
There's literally a little genie lives inside his typewriter.
Well, I think it actually does have something to do with it because the guy's had a lifetime of psychic experiences. It means that he's probably inclined to be able to pick up. And we talk about psychometry, you know, we talk about.
But he's not psychic. His typewriter's psychic.
Well, but maybe it's because he's psychic, he's able to pick up on the entity that's inside his typewriter. If you or I, you know, went and picked up that typewriter, we'd just be like, okay.
Why is the typewriter psychic?
I don't know. But there's an entity residing in the typewriter. But for what reason and where it came from?
Why is it in the typewriter?
Well, we were just talking about animism. You know, this idea where everything has a consciousness to it. I don't know why. Maybe the typewriter, like, this is my job. And so all of a sudden it creates, like, Greenhouse, I didn't even go there today because it was like, I can't even get my head around it. Greenhouse went so far as to suggest that all precognitive events are actually tulpas. And I'm like, what? Like, what are you talking about? That just doesn't make sense. And basically from what I was trying to, at the very end of the day, after I read all these other stories, trying to get my head around, is he was suggesting that people that have precognitive experiences are actually creating the events in their mind. And because they might be powerful enough to do it, and because so many people have similar precognitive events that align, it actually generates the event to take place. So rather than it being a self-conscious entity, it's like the event itself is a thought form. And then it's got this weird, again, this paradox where it's like a feedback loop onto itself. And I'm like, oh.
I mean, maybe he's just contacting his daemon.
Maybe.
Because when writers sit down and they put themselves into altered states and all these words just start flowing through, the idea is that they're connecting with their assistant consciousness, with their daemon. And the daemon isn't restricted by the physical universe in the way that we are.
No.
It's not restricted by the brain. It can possibly see into the future, see into other dimensions. So when a writer's in touch with their assistant soul, their daemon, the words will just flow and visions will flow and they work in harmony with it.
Well, allegedly he went to the sinking of the Titanic.
So he was just floating there.
And this was reported.
Is his typewriter, does it transform into a time machine and he steps inside?
No, but look, as outrageous, right, as that sounds, like it's an absolutely outrageous claim. Other writers have reported on it, but you know what I found out about Morgan Robertson? Morgan Robertson actually claims to have been the inventor of the periscope, right? But he was usurped by, apparently it was, and this is what I think that maybe what it's being told here in Greenhouse's book, there might be a ring of truth to it because with this idea of this assistant, right? So he wrote a book, which was about a submarine that was like one of the first fictional appearances of a periscope,
yeah.
Right? But guess what? His patent was rejected because the patent for the periscope had actually been submitted by the Navy 2 years before, but no one knew about it.
Hmm.
So I'm wondering if he had a vision of a submarine with a periscope and he's like, oh, that's a great idea. I'll write that one down. And he tried to patent it. Then the other wild thing that happened about Robertson is he wrote a book, right? At a time where US-Japanese relations were not in news headlines. They were just not in the vernacular at all. Well, he wrote a book about the US and Japan getting into a battle, getting into a deep war that was preceded by a sneak attack by the Japanese.
Yeah, right.
It's Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
It's wild. It's absolutely wild. But guess what happened to Morgan Robertson? Morgan Robertson.
Typewriter.
The typewriter left.
Left him.
The entity inside the typewriter left. It was, and it never came back. He could never get this. It was like it had come in and it had given him these three stories.
Cheating on him with another writer.
Well, maybe. I mean, maybe it went to Philip K. Dick. I mean, maybe that's what happened to it. But it left. The guy went into absolute despair and at 53 committed suicide at the beach or at the shore.
Because his typewriter left him, Aaron. Are you heartless? Of course he's going to commit suicide.
The entity. I'm not laughing about him committing suicide. It's horrible. But I find it fascinating. Again, though, you know, we hear these warnings, and I know I say it a lot, but it's like we've got Barker, who ends up getting involved in this stuff and dies a premature, seemingly premature death, which is mediated by a metaphysical illness. You've got Morgan Robertson, who is traveling seemingly through time for his own financial gain and glory, ultimately committing suicide. It's like the more that people mess with this stuff, it never seems to have a really wonderful outcome for them. It's either a mediocre outcome where they go into obscurity or it results in people's deaths. It's a strange thing. But going back to when we're looking at the differences between proximity and emotions,
There was also this German researcher who during the Second World War, was able to, you know, find some very, very unusual cases of people that had strong emotional precognitive events that were connected to their family members. And there's an entire chapter in Greenhouse's book where he focuses on war experiences, because it does appear that some type of, I don't know, trauma, and obviously the Second World War, any war, induces a massive amount of psychic trauma upon a populace that seems to cause a rise in these precognitive events taking place and being recorded. And this is what's, you know, really important, is that many of these particular reports, they're not ambiguous because they're written down. They're written down in diaries. You know, it's people have dream diaries where they write them down. There was one woman who, you know, she had a wild experience where she had kept a dream diary. And she woke up in a fright one evening, this terrible fright, because she'd had a dream of some strange character, what appeared to be this Man in Black type character carrying a pearl-handed gun. Like, you know, there's guns that have that pearling kind of effect on it.
Yeah.
And it killed her daughter. Like, she just got this impression that it killed her daughter. And she was so distressed by this because it was more than just a simple nightmare. You know,
you mean the man killed her daughter?
Yeah, the man killed her daughter, like using this gun, right? So she gets up. And she goes, and her daughter was sleeping in the front living room. So she gets up because she's so overwhelmed by this experience that she walks into the living room to not only check on her daughter, but she checks on her daughter and she's like, no, I'm going to bring her to my bed. So she does. She picks her up and she brings it for no reason. It's just because she had this horrible, only for her, not for her daughter's sake. Like, she's got, her daughter's fine. She wakes up in the morning, the daughter brings the pillow and she's like, oh, Mum, what's this? There's a hole that's been blown in the pillow and inside it is a bullet. They look and someone had fired a gun from outside the house and it had gone through the very thin boarding and had gone into the pillow. So obviously it was just, it seemingly was a random shot that had been fired out in the night. But had she not gotten her daughter, had she not intervened, her daughter probably would have been killed or extremely maimed. But I'm assuming because it went into the pillow that it would have caused a head injury and she'd be dead.
And so... when did the Final Destination effect kick in?
Ah, so yes, okay. So we'll come. Actually, I'll jump forward to that. Before we get to that, though, I do want to mention these German cases, because there's three of them here, which are quite, you know, they really do set the scene for this kind of stuff.
So the daughter survived. That's
the daughter
what I'm
survived.
Getting at. I mean, if this Final Destination thing is
true,
is does she get you know, hit by a bus a week later or something?
No, that's not one of those particular cases, but there are those cases that come up in a moment. But let me come back to, you know, some of these war precognition examples. So there was a German soldier who he finds himself captured by Russian troops, and the Russian troops start shooting all the other captured German soldiers. And he's got this, kind of, I don't know, it's like a gray scarf around his neck because he's got a neck wound. And as he's there, he's just like, oh my God. And he starts screaming out for his mother, right? But inside his mind, he's not doing it, you know, out in public. You know, it's, I suppose the way that this is written, because it was written by, you know, a German psychologist, that maybe it was like, they don't want to make out that the Germans were obviously terrified. But he does, he's in his mind, he just starts screaming out for his mother when all of a sudden, this higher Russian officer appears and says, don't shoot him, we need to go and interrogate him. Mm. And so his life is saved. And because he was interrogated and he handed over information, he was actually let go at the end of the war and was able to return home to his mother. His mother presents him with this diary entry. And the diary entry is from years earlier, years and years and years earlier, where his mother had this dream of her son as a grown-up coming to her with a gray scarf and a wound in his neck, asking for help so that she can do something. And so what she did is, on the night that this happened and that he was going to be shot, she suddenly got this overwhelming precognitive feeling that something was going to happen. She sat up all night praying for her son.
Oh, wow.
So it's this weird kind of paradox again, where
so
it's like,
what's the time difference there?
Years. Years and years and years. So she started having this dream years in the past.
When he was just a little kid.
When he was a little kid, of her son coming to her begging for help.
Wow. Yeah, and so her prayers may have saved his life.
Yeah. And then there's another story which is very similar to this, of a German mother who, when her child was, you know, very, very young, you know, a few years old, she started having dreams about him being, unfortunately, he's dead. Like, she knows he's dead in the dream, but he's buried on a beach. And she finds herself like on this beach, like searching through the sand, trying to find him. And she's throwing sand, and she's so distressed. And she wakes up in the morning and she's just like, oh my God, that was a terrible dream. She had this dream on and off for 27 years.
27 years this dream went on for. And she's like, oh my God, you know, what does this mean? And this is a great example of how, you know, in contrast to what Osis pointed out, that many of these stories, you know, are very much related to proximity. Like, you've got to be in proximity. Mm. It's only overcome by things like parental relationships. So sadly, her son is killed in the Second World War. So these dreams started in the First World War. Her son is killed in the Second World War and she can't find him. She cannot find his body. She later on finds out that his body, he was taken in by the French and his body had been buried on a beach. So it was like, and she was able to go and find him and recover his body. And so it doesn't actually say if she fully recovered him, but that obviously put her on the right path to be able to go and do that. And then this is a good story because that's quite horrible. And I must say, there's numerous stories in this book that as a parent, I couldn't even bring myself to complete because there's plenty of stories of poor parents losing their children, having precognitive, mm-hmm. you know, dreams about losing their children and not being able to do anything about it.
And I had the same problem as a pianist. I just couldn't bring myself to talk about the stories. Many pianos were destroyed.
Anyway, one good story though is again, it's one of these weird paradoxes. Is of a young woman. She must have been a teenager in her late teens, and there was a bombing raid that was taking place. Now, in this bombing raid, she's inside a train carriage of some kind, and her mother had this exact dream. Now, as she's inside this train carriage, she looks over, and just in the distance, you've kind of got the station, and you've got where it dips down, where there's a wall, you know, for the station wall, for where the train will pull in, so you can step straight into the train without having to climb up, and it's a piece of concrete. Now, she thinks, in this bombing raid, in the panic and all the confusion of what's taking place, that she's like, I've got to get out of the train, because it's going to bomb the train. But we all know, I guess you don't know at the time, but bombing back then was not accurate by any means. But she goes to run to this piece of concrete and thinks that she can duck down and hide in this piece of concrete when all of a sudden something grabs hold of her. And this is like the third man effect. Something grabs hold of her and pulls her back, like reefs her back. And as a result, she feels this compulsion to get back into the carriage, right? So she gets back into the carriage, looks over, a bomb lands precisely where she was going to go, killing another person who had gone there. So it had missed the carriage and had, you know, unfortunately killed this poor other young girl that was there. She goes home and she tells her mother about this. Her mother presents a dream diary or a record or journal of some kind, describing the dream, and the dream was the mother saw this all happen to the daughter, and as the daughter was running from the train carriage years earlier, she screams out and reefs her daughter back. It's mad. It's weird. How is it that this stuff, it seems to permeate space-time? And this is something that Greenhouse describes. He describes it that, and much like what you said before, Ben, is that we have this linear understanding of what time is, and it seems to, even though you've got, you know, relativity, you know, time seems to travel at this certain speed and it's only linear and only travels in one direction. Outside of this reality, outside of what we understand of this reality, it seems like time is completely malleable. It's a fabric. It's something that can be, you know, moved. It's something that can be changed. It's something that can be, it's very malleable.
It has its rules in our physical dimension, but once you're outside of our physical dimension,
that's right,
the rules don't apply anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So coming back to the pianos, Ben, although there are no specific stories of pianos falling on people after they survive plane crashes, but I'm sure they're out there somewhere. There's a couple of stories that come up from this old legend. So there was this book that was written many, 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 many years ago. It's an old kind of tale. I think it's like an Arabic tale of some kind. But it describes this scene of where there's a young man and he was moving through Baghdad and he was moving through the souk or the little markets that were there. And as he's traveling through, he's collecting something for his master. And he goes to this particular shop to collect something for his master. And as he does, this woman hands him, you know, the object that he was purchasing. I don't know if it was a piece of fruit or something. And he looks up because the woman has this very fine and delicate, these delicate features, and she's white. Like she's full on.
She's white.
As in not white as in Caucasian. She's white as in the color, right? As white as your t-shirt. And she, he is stunned. Like he's absolutely stunned and he's terrified. He's like, because it's death, right? This, you know, whimsical woman in white is death. And it's funny that this should be the legend, like this urban legend of this story, because in many precognitive, like Victorian style events, even Edwardian, you know, where people have precognitive dreams about death,
There's a reoccurring theme of the white lady of the dream.
Really?
So people that have an experience with the white lady, and what it is, it's like just a woman wearing a white dress. When she appears, she's a portent of death. Right? And this is repeated like through English history and these stories that come
up. So when did the Grim Reaper come about?
Well, I don't know, right? This is just an urban legend, but he sees this Grim Reaper death in the street and he runs, like he gets the hell out of there and he runs back to his master. And when he gets back to, wherever he is with his master, he tells his master exactly the story that I told you, that death had come. And his master's like, that's absurd. That's absolutely absurd. Why would death not take you? Like, if you met death,
what's so special about you?
Why did she take you? And this guy is like, oh my God, like I have to get out of here. I have to go to the next town. I have to go to the next town. And the master, seeing how freaked out his servant is, says, yeah, of course. And it gives him a camel and sends him off to his next town, right? But this master is intrigued. He's like, what is it about this death character? Why did death, leap? I'm going to go down to that market. I'm going to go down and just see death, go check out what's going on. So he does, right? He heads down into this market, according to the legend.
There's a Caucasian lady there.
There's this Caucasian lady in white. And, he says to her, oh, you're death. And apparently she's quite lovely. And she says, oh, yes, yes. And he says, well, you saw my servant. Why did you scare him? What were you doing? Like, what are you doing here? And she's like, oh, I was just being nice to him because I was so surprised to see him here. And he's like, oh, what do you mean? Well, I have an appointment with him this afternoon in the next town. And he did, he died. He died in the next town. And so this is an example of this, people having an appointment with death, that no matter what you try to do, even though this is a folktale, this is, a legend, it sets the scene for so many of these precognitive cases where people have a precognitive dream about their own death. They do everything they can to try and avoid it. And ultimately, it ends up causing their death.
You can't escape your fate.
And I've got three cases of that for you. So the first one relates to, it's a similar kind of story, actually. It relates to a young German servant who was working for a master. And there was a trip between Hamburg and I think it's Bergendorf. And he has this dream, this precognitive dream, that he's attacked by some brigand. And this axe is brought down upon his head, and it's this horrible thing, and everything goes black, and he wakes up from this dream, and it's more than a dream. And this is what's really important with so many of these cases, because every single person, like you listening right now, we've all had that kind of dream that is just so terrifying, and you wake up, but you ultimately go, oh, okay, well, there are some people out there that do have these premonitions that, again, realer than real. Like it induces something that's far more than that standard understanding of, oh, it's just a dream. Oh, it was just a nightmare. Oh, it was just a night terror. It's something more than that. And that's exactly what happened in these three cases I'm going to describe. But he's so overwhelmed by this dream that he goes to his master and he tells his master, he says, I've just had this dream. And, I end up getting killed because I'm robbed by a brigand. And his master laughs at him. His master's like, oh, how could you be so foolish? You're so foolish. That's ridiculous. It's just a dream. You're being stupid. Don't do that. And he says, actually, now I come to think of it, I've actually got some business that needs to be conducted in Bergendorf, and I owe a man some money down there. I want you to take these 10 crown.
That's cruel.
Or whatever they were, over to Bergendorf, right? So this guy is freaking out. And it's cruel. It's very cruel. And he's completely freaking out. He does everything he can to avoid what he saw in this vision. He avoids the roads. He takes the back roads. He does just everything he can possibly imagine. He finally gets to Bergendorf and he goes into this other master's place. And he goes and he says, oh, my master has asked me to bring you this money. And he says, oh, yes, thank you. And say, mate, you need to learn to keep your mouth shut, because the servant tells this new master about his dream. And the new master goes, oh, that's actually horrible. Isn't that awful? I'm like, oh, nine. Like, why would he do that to you? That's just, even if you've had this dream and clearly it's just a dream, he shouldn't have done that to you. Oh, just wait. And what he has to do is, because he wants him to go and move the money to a different location. So this master says, I will give you one of my servants who is a guard, and he will be able to protect you to make sure that you're safe on your trip. And the guy's relieved. He's like, oh, thank God. Now I'm going to have a guard go with me. Well, the guard kills him and robs him.
The guard stabs him, yeah. Steals the money, yeah. Mutilates his corpse.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's all one of these examples of missing this appointment with death and, you know, not being able to miss this appointment with death because he did this. It's weird. It's this, again, this paradox where because he'd had the dream, the dreams had caused him to act in a certain way, which resulted in the event taking place. It's just, it's so difficult sometimes to get your mind around.
But no, really, it's just destiny. It's fate. Some things are meant to be.
Yeah, but
you can't avoid them.
But then
all the machinations of the human world can't change fate because fate is set by the heavens. Fate is set by something higher. You can't work your way around it.
But
you
then
can't change it.
This is the thing, right? But then it kind of goes, well, do you act on premonitions or do you leave them? Because that premonition can cause the event to take place in the first place.
Better not to just have them at all.
Well, but this is like...
just be completely sealed off.
But it's a good example of the Premonitions Bureau, right? And what they were trying to achieve. Like they were trying to achieve a way, an early warning system to stop disasters taking place. But in light of that particular story and two more that I'm going to tell you, it's like, could it be that these premonitions then and all these people writing it actually cause an event to take place? Could it lead to a larger, you know, catastrophe taking place later on? Like it's just, it becomes a very complex web and a real mess. And I think you're right. There kind of is this feeling of like, we're not meant to know. Like we're human beings. We are of a lower level. We can't, it's like we can't get up into the skyscraper of the level of beings and look down and see everything that's going to happen and why things have to happen. We're on that ground level and we can only see what's happening in front of us. And anything else, you know, it just makes things very complicated and...
Yeah, well, I mean, there's karmic reasons for things happening in the world.
Good point.
So if you did have the ability to change things, if you did through your own machinations, you know, stop some ordered plan from proceeding, then what damage are you doing? Because all the plans have a specific reason for being plans. Like they exist for a reason. There's wisdom, there's intelligence behind them. And if you go and mess that up, what are the repercussions? Obviously we can't see it.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And many of these cases are very much personal, you know, stories. They're about, you know, the individual. So I wonder what would happen on a grander scale, you know, like, and this is like the human, was it the Consciousness Project? You know, where they were looking at, you know, the correlation of random number generators with, you know, events that were taking place around the world. Was that just to prove that it happens, or, you know, could that data have been extended even further to actually prevent these things from taking place? But then, you know, it's done in fiction all the time. It's like if certain events don't take place, well, then it leads to greater disasters, you know, later on.
Yeah, there's also the idea of, you know, the idea of hungry ghosts in Eastern culture. Like if someone passes away and they don't have the right funeral rites, they kind of just have to wander and continue on. There's also the idea that if you killed someone, for example, if you murdered someone and you murdered them when they were reasonably young, I guess just for the sake of this example.
So they have time, allegedly.
Well, you might have cut short their life, which
influence
is
others.
Destined. And think of all the people you influence in your life, you know, the children you might have, the connections you make, the relationships you form, the ways that you affect the world for better or for worse. If you cut off someone's life, you then interfere and destroy all those plans that were set up for that person.
Have you been watching Miracle on 34th Street? Is that...
No, what's that?
That's that Christmas thing where the guy goes, I wish I was dead or I wish it never existed. And the whole movie is about how it influenced everyone else's life.
It's like the whole back...
Whatever that, yeah.
It's like the whole Back to Future thing disappearing in the photos. But the concept is in terms of karma, because there's karma, obviously doing something wrong and evil, like killing someone, you receive karma for that.
Oh, maybe I got that.
But it's not,
whatever.
It's not just that person's life that you have to pay for. It's all the plans and destiny that you've screwed up that were connected with that person.
Yeah, and all those people that they were going to influence and all those events that were going to take place. So
it's
it has this
whole butterfly effect. You're basically ruining it. You're destroying all these elaborate plans of destiny for each individual.
Well, but it seems like this fabric, this mechanism, it has a self-healing property to it. And that's what these particular cases are. It's like it's so intelligent, it's so well-regulated that no matter what people try to do, it does change things. But then again, I'm like, is this thing happening on purpose? Because if these people aren't given these premonitions, they wouldn't have died. That's the other weird thing. It's like if they
wouldn't they have died though?
Well, no, they probably.
You're just presuming that.
Well, that's a good. Well, no, well, those particular cases, it took place because of the. Listen to the paradox. In that particular case, it happened because he told the new master about it, and he assigned him a guide, And that guy is the guy that killed him. If he hadn't have told the master about it. Yeah, but
if he didn't tell the master, maybe someone else would have robbed him. That's my point.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that's what it is as well. That's a good point. So the two other cases, one was a Scottish guy. It was a Scottish guy that had this terrible recurring dream that he drowned. And it was horrible. Like, it was always at this very specific lake. Like, he always knew what it was. And he vowed to never go to a lake district ever again. He's like, that's it. I'm never going to a lake. Well, it just so happens the day after he had made this decision, his company, his business required him to go to a lake. And he's like, oh, yeah, okay. So he goes to a lake, right? He goes to this lake. And this is the thing. He goes down to this lake. It's exactly what he saw in his vision.
Oh, boy.
And he, like, I get it. If you're having these dreams and precognitions about dying in a lake and you go to a lake that looks different.
Just wait, like, just wade out into the water. Just get it over with.
I know. Like,
just so drown yourself.
He comes to this lake, but for whatever reason, because he has to do his job, he's like, okay, I'll just go.
Okay.
So he goes down to the water, right? And as part of this water, he has to cross a certain area of it. And there's a whole heap of other people that are around. And they're all in these boats. He's with other people that are doing whatever the business is. It's not said. But he's like, oh, okay. So he thinks, right, because he kind of knows further up where the event took place. So he's in the boat and he's sitting there. He's like, okay, all right, yep. And he starts getting closer. He thinks that he's going to beat the dream, right? There's a jetty that's kind of, you know, sticking out where he's like, oh, if I get off on this jetty, I can actually walk across that water over there because it's shallow enough for me to wade through. So he doesn't care about getting wet. So he says to the driver, he's like, let me get off on this jetty and I'll meet you on the other one. And I'm like, you're being foolish. Like, you're being really foolish. He's like, no, I'll get off here.
So we're all just waiting for him to die. The part of the story where he dies.
The jetty collapses as he gets off and he drowns. He did.
Someone had put a piano on the jetty and the weight was so much that the jetty just collapsed. That's what the piano killed him. It didn't drop on his head.
His piano keys as it collapses in a splash.
To be fair, it didn't drop on his head, but the piano did kill him.
So it's piano cognition. So yeah, another example though, had he not had that recurring dream about dying in this circumstance, he wouldn't have gotten off on that jetty and he wouldn't have died in that particular way. But then again, you know, because he'd had the vision further down, like the vision was showing him drowning further down, maybe if he'd persisted that he would have actually died and it was always going to happen. It's like no matter what with fate, it's always going to happen. You can't control it. You can't get around it.
Well, there must be intelligences that make sure the designs of your life proceed as planned.
I think
so. A death would be an example of that. Like when death comes to collect you, death is basically performing its task. Remember we covered the stories from that little village in China of the people, there was a guy that was basically recruited by kings of the underworld to act as like a Grim Reaper type of individual.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And he would essentially, there was some like deal he had to make with them where he would be their assistant and he would leave his body at night. And he was basically like an assistant for the Grim Reaper. He would go to neighboring village of a guy who was about to have a heart attack and he would wait like out of his body in this astral form, wait for the guy to have a heart attack and then basically grab him, put him in handcuffs and take him away to the underworld. So if this guy's going to the lake, is there entities, is there spirits around? Is there some intelligence that makes sure that he dies that day?
Like I think so.
And it might not take the form of his dream. If he doesn't have the dream, maybe there's some other way and they make sure that it happens.
Well, here's a really great example because often the way that it happens, it's quite absurd. Like it's almost, it's not comical in that it's funny, but it's comical in the way that these things take place because you have, death is a very serious thing, but in some of these reports, it's like, yeah, the jetty collapsed. And this next one is a similar kind of thing. It has this weird comical kind of ending to it because there was a guy who was a British captain in the Navy or something like that. He was high up in some authority and he was retiring. And because he was retiring, he was going to be given this like 21-gun salute, and which is standard protocol. Like it's just a standard thing for these captains to Navy men to take place to say their farewell when they're retiring. And the day before he's supposed to have this retirement party or this event to take place, ceremony, I suppose, he has a precognitive dream that he's shot in the 21-gun salute. He's killed by one of a misfiring in the 21-gun salute. So he gets up in the morning and is like, well, I'm not going. There's just no way in hell I'm going. It's just not going to happen. And so he calls up to, you know, whoever he has to call, and they're insistent, like, no, it's your retirement ceremony. You have to come to this. He's like, nope, I'm not going. And this guy, he must have a friendship with, because he finally tells him, he's like, I had this terrible dream. It's more than a dream. I was shot in the 21-gun salute. And the guy goes, oh, is that all? Well, all we have to do is just not do the 21-gun salute. And he's like, oh, yeah, okay. Well, if you're going to let me, you know, retire without that part of the tradition, well, then, yeah, that's great. So he's like, okay, we won't do the 21-gun salute. He goes, he gets on the boat, and off they go. And there's a few boats around because it's in a harbor or something. Mm. And they're there, and all, it's kind of like this peer pressure, this group pressure. Well, they're all just like kind of giving him a ribbing, and it's very military kind of style. And he was just like, oh, you know, come on. Oh, you're having a dream. Oh. And he's like, oh, okay, fine. We can do the 21-gun salute. But, and this is what the captain of this particular vessel says to him, to the guy that's retiring. He's like, look, what I'll do to make sure that nothing happens to you is that we'll get on the boat. We'll get on, you know, this little motorboat that we have, and we'll go away, and I'll give the signal by waving my hand to tell them to do the 21-gun salute when I'm far enough away. Like, when we're far enough away and there's no chance of you being shot, they can do the salute.
Why would you agree to this when you've just had this vivid dream? Because you would still say no.
Because that didn't happen in the dream, right? It's very specific. He was shot on the vessel. And so he's like, well, I'm on the boat and I'll be far enough away. It's fine, right? So he agrees. So he gets in, the two of them, they get in, they start driving away, right?
And I love that we already know the ending to all these stories before you even start telling them.
A fly.
What?
A fly lands on the nose of the captain, and the captain starts swatting it away. And the 21-gun salute go, oh, we have to fire. And they shoot the guy retiring.
Oh, my God.
He dead.
That's awful.
But isn't it crazy? It's absolutely crazy. He had this such a strong precognitive dream, precognition that this was going to take place, and things were put all into effect to stop it, but it caused his death. Because if he'd remained on the boat, it's unlikely that he would have been shot, because the fly wouldn't have landed on the captain's nose and he wouldn't have waved his hand prematurely.
He still would have been shot, though.
Well, maybe he would have been. Thing. But maybe he wouldn't.
Because in the example I gave of the Chinese guy that left his body and became like an enforcer for the underworld, there were some instances where the person they needed to collect didn't die. It was like, Xiu Ping needs to die of a heart attack, and they're just waiting around all night and he doesn't die. So I remember from that story, they had like these massive silver hammers in another dimension. And if he didn't die, they were just like, whack! And they would just smack him on the head and he would have like a brain hemorrhage and die.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so they just made sure. They were like, okay, we've got to collect this guy. We've got to make sure he dies.
It's keeping up.
He didn't die of
the
heart attack, but let's just take care of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and maybe that's exactly what's occurring here. And this is the thing. Like, maybe this is something that we obviously don't understand. It's something which is so foreign to human consciousness, but through observation, which is what we do as human beings, and we talk about the science, well, science is observation. We're managing to observe these events taking place because it's natural. It is actually something. It's like a naturalist can look at and go, well, this is part of what reality is. It's being maintained. But then, like, there's other examples. It's not all bad, right? So there are three cases of, you know, how horrible it can be. There are other examples of where, you know, some type of precognitive event can take place which can save you, you know, especially around water. Was one example of a woman that had this terrifying reoccurring dream that her son drowned. And it was never any specific circumstance. It was just that her son drowned. And so finally one day her husband goes to take the kid out in a boat. And straight away, she's like, oh my God, you know, you have to put a life jacket on. And he's like, oh, you don't have to put a life jacket. But she was so insistent. She was like so over the top, almost, I'm going to divorce you if you don't do this insistent. Mm. That he's like, okay, fine. They get out into the middle of the lake. They overturn. The child survived because he was wearing the life jacket. So it was like, there is something positive that came about from this. Then there's also other horrible circumstances as well. There's like, as I was describing a little bit earlier, like with that third man effect happening, many of these precognitive cases, which Greenhouse references, they're not just dreams. There's a whole heap of dream kind of things that take place. There's a few visions. A lot of people hear voices. It's like a voice that will suddenly appear and tell them to do something. It will influence them to do something. It'll be like someone shouting in the house. And if they heed that, it seems to allow them to avoid certain things. There was one case of a car, for example. There was, I believe, a French couple that were driving through an alpine kind of region. And as they're driving through this region, some voice from behind them, this couple, screams at them and says, stop. And they stop and they're just like, oh, that's kind of weird. They can't see anyone. They can't hear anyone. There's no one else around. So they keep on driving. And as they're driving, the voice becomes more insistent. Stop! And they stop. I'm like, nothing. Keep, and they keep on driving until finally it's like this bellowing, stop. And they do. They stop, right, and they get out of the car. And as they stop and get out of the car, they look and the front left-hand wheel collapses because there was a linchpin, they found it later on, that had failed in the car, in that axle. And had they driven any further, if they'd remained in the car and had driven further, that collapsing of that wheel would have caused them to go over the edge of the cliff.
Oh, right.
So that's, you know, this weird kind of third man effect, vocal effect, you know, induce something. Then there's more horrible cases, though, going back to dreams of where a young woman had this terrible dream one night where she her father appeared to her, but like a scary kind of, you know, corny movie, he's holding his head, kind of like holding his head up, you know, and she wakes up. She's like, what the hell was that? Like,
he's holding his own head.
He's holding his own head.
Gross.
You know, like a Halloween character. And she's like, that's horrible. Well, 2 days later, he dies in a plane crash and he's decapitated. Now that's...
Still, put your head back on if you're going to appear to family members.
But there was this one. And sometimes with these dreams and these visions, they can be so extremely abstract that it's difficult to understand. But this is a proximity case that I should probably mention, you know, before we start wrapping this up. This proximity case related to... this guy who has a dream, well, there's a knock at his door and he goes and opens the door and it's just like some, you know, French 17th century kind of telegram deliverer. It is, here you are, sir. And he thanks him for the envelope and he opens it up and it's written in this red ink and it's like this, it's an order. It's like an order for the extermination or the execution of a young woman. And in the dream, it all kind of makes sense, right? But in the dream, he's like, why would this woman... You know, why would there be not only this order to execute this young woman, but it's actually written by the woman who's being executed. So she's ordering her own execution. And he's finding it very odd, you know, in this dream until he walks into his bedroom, still in the dream space in this event that's taking place. What he finds, there's this head, right? There's this head where he's holding the head of this young woman. And there's blood everywhere and he can feel like he starts to freak out because he's holding the decapitated head of this young woman. And there's blood and it's all too much. And he wakes up in this hot sweat and he's like, oh God, that's just awful. Like what a horrible experience. It's no connection to anyone. There's no family members. There's no one around him. Like none of it makes any sense until reading the paper a couple of days later, he finds out on the night that he had this dream, a young woman in the neighborhood had gone and laid down on the railroad tracks outside his house and had put her neck on the train line and was decapitated on the train line. So she had ended her own life. And yet this guy living across the railroad tracks on the night that it happens gets a dream of an execution order written by the woman to herself.
That's weird.
Isn't it weird? There's no emotional connection. There's nothing. There's no connection whatsoever. And yet somehow this guy has this odd dream of a true event taking place not far from his home.
Charming one to finish the show on, Aaron.
Well, okay, so the last one I have to finish on, which is actually, you know, coming full circle about, you know, everyone that gets involved in this kind of stuff, we come back to Herbert Greenhouse himself and his own experience. And that is with the mischievous sprite known as Sunbeam. So
that's right. I forgot about this.
This relates to, he has a chapter that refers to like you know, religious, supernatural kind of experiences. And there's this reverend by the name of Reverend Adrienne Coulter. And it's this woman who in the 1970s, she conducts seances, right? Which is obviously outside the realms of what normally, you know, this certain religious denomination would do. But, you know, she was conducting these seances. And she would come up with premonitions, like she would have precognitive, you know, thoughts and visions about things that are going to take place. And she would tell people about them until finally Greenhouse asks her, he's like, well, how are you doing this? What is it like? You know, how are you getting the vision? She's like, it's not coming from me. It's coming from Sunbeam. And he's like, what's Sunbeam? What the hell is that? And she's like, oh, it's this sprite that I found in the house and it just hangs around and it gives me all the abilities.
Did she find it in a typewriter?
Well, that's kind of the implication, right? But she allows this thing to possess her. I'm like, oh, honey, like, wow.
Allows it to possess
her to then bring the information through, right? And Greenhouse is skeptical of this. He's like, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. Until Sunbeam shows up and Sunbeam's like, oh, Your car. He's like, what about my car? It's like the carburetor. It's fucked. And he's like, and then the fuel line will be fucked as well. And he's like, this is ridiculous. Like, this is so absurd and ridiculous. So he leaves.
So she's channeling this entity, giving him information on his car.
Apparently trashes the house. And I'm like, why are you allowing this thing to hang around? You know, it's just crazy. So he leaves, and as he leaves, his car starts vibrating, and boom. And he's like, what the hell? So he has to get his car taken to a garage, and he goes to the garage, he talks to the mechanic, and he says to the mechanic, oh, it must be the carburetor. And the mechanic's like, nah, it's not the carburetor. It's something else. Yeah. And he checks it, right? And he apparently fixes the car. He gets the car back, and like a day later, blows up again. So he goes back, and he's like, oh, yeah, actually, it was a carburetor. Oh, I don't know. We missed that. All right. So they replaced the carburetor and his car's fine. A couple of days later, poof, car blows up again. So I was like, oh, come on. He's like, oh, maybe that sprite is real. Like, maybe it is the fuel line. So he goes back to the mechanic. He's like, it's the fuel line. The mechanic's like, nah, it's just the carburetor again.
Why does the mechanic talk like this?
I don't like him either.
Sounds like a jerk.
He's a jerk, right? So he replaces the carburetor again, costing this guy money. Car blows up. I don't know why he keeps on going back to the same guy. The guy's like, oh, yeah, it's the fuel line. He's like, I told you it was the fuel line. I told you it was the carburetor the first time. And he stops. He's like, that's what was told to me by the sprite that I didn't believe actually existed. But it was almost like, and now you got to wonder, did the sprite purposely blow up his car to cause him to become a believer? Because, you know, we talk about low-level spirits. Or is it just that it was kind of like a show of power, because that was always going to happen?
The sprite knew what was going on.
The sprite always knew. So, but it demonstrated two precognitive events. It was able to predict two events that would, even though it was, the carburetor was replaced twice, so technically it's three, but it was able to predict two precognitive events that were going to take place. So, don't know what to make of that, but I'll link to the book in the show notes, mysteriousuniverse.org. I don't know if there's many copies left. I did look on Amazon and they were rather expensive, but this is why I grab these books when I find them, Ben.
$500 worth,
it's worth
of books that used to be 33 cents at the airport in the 1950s.
Well, inflation's like 9% at the moment, Ben, so it makes sense that'd be very expensive now. So, of course, yeah, all of that, as I said, in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org. Make sure you check it out.
I opened one of those books as I was going through them yesterday, and I opened one and out falls this green pamphlet, and it's a call for auditions to join the drama club of Lord's Theatre in London somewhere. And I look at the date. This thing's brand new. Like, it looks like it's just
brand
been printed.
Yeah.
It's from 1982. Falls out of one of these books. That's how old these things are.
Like,
no one's opened that since 1982.
Yeah, it's weird.
The funny thing is they obviously used it as a bookmark, but they're only one third into the book. So they're like, this is shit. And they didn't finish it. So I've got those upstairs if you want to do those next.
So you've got up to one third covered and then you're just like, I'm not going to do any more. That's
pretty
it.
Much.
Someone else has already read it.
Looking forward to the Plus extension coming up. We're going to look at the work of Steve Taylor with Extraordinary Awakenings. People he calls shifters who have these radical spiritual transformations that seem to be triggered from intense suffering, intense turmoil. He calls the phenomenon transformation through turmoil, or TTT. But I've noticed with the stories we've covered over the years, especially with people that seem to have supernormal abilities, we often find that if you look into their childhood, specifically as well,
they've had a long history of it.
You see intense trauma, intense tribulations. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a connection with this trauma, with this turmoil, and strange spiritual shifts in consciousness. We've got a lot of war stories coming up. Soldiers share their stories in his work as well, along with strange tales. I want you to let me know if you share my opinion that it's not just one individual involved. It seems like there's other entities getting involved with these people.
Ooh, okay.
That's coming up after the break. If you want to get access to that, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. Sign up today and you get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single Friday. And if you're a Plus member, you get exclusive shows on Tuesday as well. Plus members also get a higher quality version of the show in terms of audio. You get a higher bitrate feed. You also get a totally ad-free version of the show. And if you want to get our entire back catalogue, we have MU Max available. as well. Sign up for MU Max and you get access to everything we've ever done on the website and in your own unique feeds as well. Check it out today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus Extension. Great to have you with us.